It's Saturday, October 31st. Happy Halloween. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 889 and KOSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. Hi, I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer.
Hey, Lyle.
How's it going, Brian?
Great.
We also have Mr. Miles Elam, political junkie and software engineer.
Hello, Lyle.
And last but not least, Mr. Ben Jaffe, a teacher, a traveler, and a music geek.
Aloha.
Nice. Do you do different ones of those every week?
I think I say aloha a little too often.
Okay.
Maybe I'll prepare a Klingon greeting for next week.
Let's start up with some Facebook follow-up, shall we, Brian?
Yeah. So last week we were talking about how the Facebook app on the iPhone was using an inordinate amount of battery power. It was sucking down battery so much. In fact, my wife's phone was showing that 50% of the battery power was used by
the Facebook app
alone.
That's a lot.
A big reason we know this is because the iOS, the newer operating system, can actually tell you this. So if you've got iOS 9...
Hers isn't updated to 9 yet. She was on 8, so it just said how much battery power it used. If you have 9, it'll actually show you the amount that is in the foreground versus the background.
Cool.
So the important part here is that the Facebook app was consuming a lot of battery power in the background. The apps can stay awake for certain processes. And Facebook acknowledged the problem this week, and they released a fix, and they talked about what they said are the reasons why I was doing this. And it was very similar to what the different bloggers that had looked into this had discovered. Although they claim that the reason why the app was staying awake was because of this audio process. Whenever you played a video on Facebook and then left the Facebook app, it would be like the video was still producing audio.
Right.
Only it was very quiet audio.
This is what people claim they were doing is fakely playing silent audio to stay live. But what they're saying is actually it was a bug.
Yes. And there's no way to figure out either one of those, which one is the
trust,
truth.
Trust, Brian. Trust.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing it was doing network calls that were spinning. And it would basically be like saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
Mm-hmm.
Which is how Ari Grant, the Facebook engineering manager, described that little bug that they cleaned up. So.
Well, after you talked about it, and then I heard about it on other podcasts this last week, I decided, you know what? I'm just going to uninstall Facebook. I didn't have the problem. I looked at memory consumption. And the reason probably I didn't have the problem is I almost always have good network at work and at home. I've got really good network. And then actually my travel, I'm on a shuttle, and the shuttle has good network. So I didn't have the network problem. And then additionally, I listen to so much podcasts. Anytime I have an opportunity to, I listen to podcasts. And of course, as soon as you played another audio, you would have disabled the video audio bug of Facebook's. So I didn't have the problem, and possibly maybe because there's other reasons as well. But I realized I don't need Facebook installed on my phone. I seem to use it all the time. And what I've done is I switched to paper, which is a little less obsessive and a little less annoying in my mind. And I still get to see the followers that I want to follow. So
Yeah, exactly.
Paper is an app?
Yeah, Facebook made an app called Paper. That has
I'm like, how are you communicating with people via paper? Like, is there a system that allows that or something?
It would be awesome if I just was like, yeah, Facebook, no more. What I'm doing is mailing a lot.
It's very asynchronous, but, yeah, it works.
Yeah.
Real coders use Carrier Pigeon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So this is only one data point. There's not a lot to go on, but my wife's phone now shows 27% Facebook usage instead of 50%. So this is looking good.
That's pretty accurate for her usage. Okay. All right. Good. And we actually have more follow-up, and that is ad blocking.
Oh, yeah. We've talked about ad blocking on various shows over the past 6 months. I thought this was funny because, ad blocking is only possible because we have control over our browsers. The websites can't control everything that goes in and out of our browsers. We actually have some control over that. But in the rest of our life, we don't have control over billboards, and we don't have control over magazines and movies, to some degree TV. But like in theme park lines, there's even advertisements up on the TV. So this Twitter picture that you can see when you go to geekspeak.org is a riot. It is Times Square if all the ads were blocked out of the way.
Oh, nice. Yes. Right. Of course, New York's Times Square is famous for these giant billboard ads all over the place.
So if you were to look forward into the future a little bit, and when we actually have augmented reality glasses on our face, like the HoloLens or one of the other ones that's in development, you can imagine we would finally have the control to block out all these ads or probably be charged to have them replaced with other ads. But anyways, take a look at that at geekspeak.org.
You know what's funny about that actually is, so all of us in this room, all four of us, do some amount of web development. And so, of course, there's always that moment when there's some modal dialogue that's blocking some content on the page, and you're like, oh, I just want to read what's behind the thing. So what do? We right-click, inspect element, and delete the node, which is blocking, and now we can see all the content behind it. You can't do that for real life, regrettably. Wouldn't it be nice to be walking down the street, and you see a billboard, and you just like reach out with your right pinky and click on it, delete. Nice. That'd be cool. But right. Possibility. It's a possibility with
so
AR.
Then I know what you want to avoid watching, but what have you actually been watching lately?
Right. So you work at Netflix, so that's a good question for you to ask me. I'm not watching anything new. I'm still watching Star Trek The Next Generation.
But you've seen every episode of that, haven't you?
At least three times. We're watching it again, my partner and I, and we're on season 7 right now. But we recently watched an episode called The Chase, which is episode 20 from season 6. Do you remember this one?
Is this the one where they find an ancient race that is the predecessor to all humanoids?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a great episode.
Did you really just remember that off the top of your head?
You wrote it down. Star Trek, Ancient Humanoid.
Darn it. And so you clicked on the link.
No, I didn't click on it. I knew from Ancient Humanoid the premise of it.
This was the episode that explained why anywhere you go in the Star Trek universe, there are humanoids?
Yes. Of course, Marina Sirtis,
Do you know about this episode?
I know. It was such a letdown. It was like it broke all the mystery.
But so Marina Sirtis, who played Counselor Troi on The Next Generation, says in conventions, when people ask me, excuse me, why are all of the alien races humanoid? She says, well, if a non-humanoid walks in the casting door, we'll hire them, right?
right.
That's the real reason.
Yeah,
but
of course.
This was the in-universe explanation. So the idea is that ancient humanoids from way back, you know, 4.5 billion years before the Star Trek universe happens.
As Earth is being formed.
right. They basically sent out their DNA on comets and asteroids and whatnot to seed different planets with these complex molecules, which eventually form the basis of life. And so that's the reason why all of this genetic code is similar between all these different races that are encountered in that universe. It's an interesting theory.
To be clear, this is fiction.
This is fiction. That we have not discovered that. That would be very, very big news. Bigger than water on Mars. But the idea is kind of neat, and it's actually a real scientific theory. Not that it came from ancient humanoid aliens, but the idea that these specks of dust, which got coated with ice and whatnot as they traveled through the universe from way, way, way long ago, the beginnings of the universe, got irradiated by various suns on their journey, and some of them formed complex molecules because of that incoming energy and whatever molecules were in there, and then seeded planets. And so the theory is that, at least seeded Earth. Who knows if there are other ones out there. So the theory goes that these complex molecules came to Earth as the oceans were forming about 3.8 billion years ago is the estimation. That's when we were getting bombarded by a lot of comets and asteroids. And those molecules, those particles of dust thawed out, and the complex molecules seeded the oceans and were able to kind of jumpstart life a little more quickly than if we just had the basic
molecules. If we'd waited until the seas were not boiling, right, until we actually had liquid water, and at that point then waited for creation of these complex molecules.
Or more the idea that if we only had very simple elements, it would take a lot longer for the more complex structures to emerge, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to if these complex structures were emerging on motes of dust as they traveled through for millions billions of years.
Yeah, I always thought that seeding concept was that other places produced these complex molecules and then they traveled. Not that they actually were generated by being in deep space. But there's a few things you touched on that I wanted to touch base
on.
And that is, one is this idea that as the oceans were being formed, this is a great idea. The rocky planets, the reason why they're rocky, the inner planets, theoretically is because the early time in the solar system, as the sun was being formed, everything was being bombarded a lot, and and there was a lot of high energy, which means you had a lot of molten rock, molten material. And in that environment, lighter molecules like hydrogen and helium would actually just dissipate out. They'd be pushed away from the solar winds, if you will, and you wouldn't have that stuff in the inner solar system.
Right. So all the light stuff kind of flies away.
Right. And that's one of the theories why we have like the gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn and farther out are giants.
Which are all of those really light elements,
right.
But they have stronger gravitational pulls, and so they were able to hold on to them maybe in their early stages of formation.
And so I remember this when we were chatting before the show that, oh yeah, we're basically just like core heavy material, and then over time, material from the outer solar system came in, comets and such, and deposited all the lighter material we have. That's where we got our atmosphere. But you questioned that before the show, and so I looked it up, and I found out that story is a lot more complicated than that.
It's
probably too much to get into,
yeah.
But there are a whole bunch of different ways of why and how water, for example, got to our planet, and all of them are probably additive, right?
There's
different. We're not sure where percentage
different
came
sources.
From where.
Yeah, it's not just like, oh, these all the water came from this one theory.
Right.
Oh no, I think all the water came from this theory. It's probably that there's a little truth to at least a lot of the theories out there.
One of the arguments against life being created on Earth is that you have a period of time where it's extremely hot and then it starts to cool down. And we're talking about 5 billion years, 6 billion years, somewhere in that range, where prior to that, no organic material could be on Earth because it would be too hot. And so then you're talking about the complete creation of all life organisms we've seen in that period of time. And maybe it's actually a lot older than that. Maybe the material came from a remote source instead.
Right, right.
And another thing to think about that I love when you talk about big space stuff like this, cosmology, is that the materials we actually see in our solar system came from exploding stars, right? Anything heavier than helium and hydrogen actually had to once be in a star.
Yeah,
to be generated
for the most part, was generated in, as Neil deGrasse Tyson puts it, the crucible of, like, his language is so intense. But yeah, inside of stars. And then some of those stars go nova, and that material gets ejected and finds our forming star and ends up somehow becoming Earth and then us. So, like, that way, we are all very much star stuff.
And I would argue that the Star Trek episode they talked about the seeding of humanoid genomes came from the scientific idea that organic
panspermia,
material.
Yeah.
What is it called?
Panspermia.
Panspermia means that other sources put the seeds of life, if you will, on Earth.
Right.
Just an outside impregnation of life onto a formerly lifeless body.
You know what's interesting about Star Trek is Star Trek gets a lot. So over the years, Star Trek has actually had science advisors who advise the writers as they're going through different ideas, saying like, yeah, this is plausible. No, this isn't plausible. Maybe it happened like this. It doesn't have to be science fact, but it has to be at least be plausible. A lot of movies could really benefit from having science advisors, as Phil Plait very often talks about whenever there's a science fiction movie that comes out.
Plugging The Martian.
The Martian.
No.
I've not seen it.
Well, I was just going to say, you're going to tell us a contemporary story that even leads more information to this. But first, we're going to take a break. Please stay with us here on KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm talking with Ben and Miles and Brian. Stay with us here on KOSP. This is Geek Speak on KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. We were talking about panspermia, right? Is that what it's called, Miles?
Yep.
Yeah, the idea that that complex molecules and or life came from somewhere external to Earth and seeded Earth, and that was the catalyst for life developing as quickly as it did. Now, this is a really interesting theory and everything. We've seen some evidence here and there, but the story that actually I'm covering now is that this year, we put two things. First of all, this year, we put our Rosetta spacecraft in orbit around Comet 67P, beautifully named. And it has a lander that pops that goes down onto the comet and actually detected 16 organic compounds as it descended and landed. So that's pretty cool. And then additional to that, we recently were looking at this comet called Comet Lovejoy, and we found that it was spewing out a lot of different organic molecules in addition to water. So specifically, they found 21 different organic molecules and gas from the comet, including glycolaldehyde. I can't pronounce those words. That's a sugar. And
can I just ask just one second?
Yes.
Miles, what defines an organic compound, an organic molecule?
When we refer to organic compounds, almost always it includes carbon, but carbon, nitrogen, and then hydrogen usually is
and
in
oxygen.
The mixer. But yes. So yeah, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen is the ones I most think of as the base of what's considered organic chemistry.
So these are naturally. I mean, they exist all over the place outside our solar system, all over the place. These exist. But when we talk about these, like we talk about complex, they're like more complicated than just like a water molecule or just carbon with oxygen on it, right? It's a more chain kind of thing. And the thing
Something
you're talking about are
carbon,
structures that are
carbon is a very that's a way to describe it, promiscuous element.
And it's got four
covalent bonds.
Yeah.
And it will attach to just about anything. And that's one of the things that really makes it that more useful. You don't normally think of gasoline as being an organic compound, and yet at the same time, octane is eight carbon
centers
atoms
with things around it.
With hydrogen connected to the excess covalent bonds. And at the same time, yeah, when you think of organic, don't think in terms of, oh, look, a human being. It's organic as in it's based upon this very flexible
which organic material uses to make its structure. It's like the reason why we're bags of mostly water, but we're also carbon, right? With organic chemistry is the building block, if you will, of life. Okay, but it doesn't mean its source came from life. Okay, go on. You were
right.
saying. What
so
was
you
the
cut
first
me off right as I said. And
no, I'm sorry.
Do you want to know what the one, of course, that all of the media outlets are latching onto is alcohol, ethyl alcohol,
as in drinkable,
as
alcohol.
In the kind of alcohol that we regularly poison ourselves with at social gatherings.
Once we were 21.
Once we're 21, yes. Right. It's kind of crazy. So, like, if you think about it from a non-scientific perspective, you can imagine that, yes, this comet, at its peak, when it was close to the sun, was releasing a massive amount of alcohol,
How much alcohol we're talking about?
Equivalent to 500 bottles of wine every second.
Every second?
Every second.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. So that's like $1,000 of $2 chuck every second. It's a lot of alcohol.
Yeah, just as a point of reference, when we talk, because a lot of folks don't have the background for organic chemistry to say what is ethanol, because many people may think like, oh, that's a really complex thing. Two carbon atoms with hydrogens all around them, except one of the hydrogens, which would otherwise be ethane, is taken off and you have an oxygen split put in the place of that hydrogen, the hydrogen put on the end, otherwise known as a hydroxyl group.
Okay. Just so one of those in the two on the two carbons?
Right.
And,
then the rest is just hydrogen on the rest of those bonds.
That's pretty simple.
So it's a pretty simple molecule, all things considered.
It occurs to me right now that it's really difficult to describe what elements look like on the radio.
Yeah, radio. Right? Radio.
but I'm glad we're having this conversation. So all of this, summing all of this up, the finding effectively is that comets, there's more evidence that comets could have been the source of the complex organic molecules that we found on Earth that were necessary for the emergence of life. So that's kind of crazy. Like, we actually may have, or rather, what we came from, what we evolved through all the millions of years from, might have come from some comet. That's
awesome.
Crazy.
That's awesome. So the stories we're talking about, we have links to from geekspeak.org. The story that you're talking about, the alcohol spewing comet, there's actually pictures of it from February. Beautiful thing in a star field from the link that you shared for this story. Do you have anything else?
Oh, yeah. I have one more thing to say. Just because Star Trek is so cool, I have to put this out there. Star Trek actually, to some extent, invented the concept of a white hole. That something goes into a black hole and spews out the other end through a white hole. That was actually mentioned in a Star Trek episode, an original series Star Trek episode, before it was mentioned in any scientific papers.
Does it exist in scientific papers?
It exists in scientific papers. It has been talked about as a real thing that
has been
theorized.
No.
Yeah.
Because that would denote wormhole action, and we don't know if that
happens. Right, yeah. Okay.
But like all discussions about Star Trek, all good things must come to an end.
Oh, no. We're almost to that episode.
All right. Let's talk about computers. since we've done some space, we've done some sci-fi, let's talk about some computers. And I'll start this out by describing one thing that people get confused about all the time. We've covered it lots of times on GeekSpeak. In fact, we used to take calls. We talk about this a lot. Your computer actually has two ways of kind of dealing with memory or storage. And we use the term memory and storage separately. Storage is where your stuff gets saved for permanent use, like your hard drive is storage, a floppy disk is storage, an optical disk like a CD is also storage, and also your memory sticks, the USB memory sticks, those are all storage. And the hard drive is definitely the most standard of those types. And then the other type is memory or RAM. And that is used by the processor to do things. And basically that's the random access memory, which is very fast.
And the way I've heard it described is in terms of speed, it's almost like your hard drive or your storage is like walking across the office, maybe down a flight of stairs, looking through a filing cabinet, and then walking back to get some information. Whereas the RAM is like picking up a piece of paper that's already on your desk. It's much, much faster.
Yeah. I also like, since we're throwing out analogies here.
Sure.
Us talking to each other face-to-face in a conversation, this is like RAM. It's very fast, very relatively efficient anyway to get across
like,
your ideas.
Like I'm accessing the information that you're saying as quickly as you're saying it, plus a little bit for the speed of sound.
Right.
Like
and
really
as soon
fast.
As we leave the room, that conversation ends. It's gone. It's
actually,
poof.
Miles, we're recording this conversation.
Yes. Analogies. Sometimes they get stretched. Now, if we had our conversation and we wanted to save it for long term, then we have to write it down. But writing it down takes longer.
It would be slower to do that, yeah.
So that's why you avoid it unless you want to talk about the issues, and then when you come across an agreement point or a highlight, then you go down, you write that important point down so that when you go back to review the minutes to a meeting or the like, you're able to reconstruct what went on, even though you don't have the exact details of every operation because that would be way too slow.
All right, I think we got it. Storage, slower. RAM, fast.
Yes.
Although courtroom stenographers type really fast.
They do.
So yes. Let's just omit them from the metaphor, right?
Well, yeah, they're also doing some really interesting things.
Wormhole alert.
So I believe that we are on the cusp of a new type of development paradigm. Now, how this will affect users, you'll just get better software, faster software. That's always been the case. But if you were developing software, this changes the game dramatically.
What precipice are we on?
The precipice of hard drives versus solid state drives. Now, hard drives, you have this piece of iron, oxidized iron, also known as rust.
Yeah.
Spinning rust on these disks that are spinning
on
at
these glass or aluminum platters.
Yeah, 7,200 RPM, 15,000 RPM.
Sure, faster.
And there's a limit to how fast the rotational speed becomes an issue. And then you have the newer drives are really trying to eke out the most speed they can. So they're injecting helium into the newest drives so that it reduces the amount of friction from the air.
Yeah, gas friction on the head that reads and actually flies above the platter.
Yes.
And actually hard drives have multiple platters in them, both top and bottom, and little tiny heads in between. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about a hard drive crashing, that's actually what it comes from. The head crashes onto the platter, ripping off the oxide on it and destroying the data.
I highly recommend if you have a hard drive die, which you will eventually.
Oh, all of them do.
Please take the time to take a screwdriver, standard Phillips head,
or
open
a Torx
it up.
Wrench. Normally a Torx wrench now, unfortunately. But yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Open them up. And look inside. What's the worst going to happen? The hard drive already failed.
Right.
Look inside and see what that looks like.
It's the most beautiful mirror you'll ever see. And
unless the crash was catastrophic.
Sure. Well, hopefully only one platter. And the magnets inside are really crazy awesome. If you can like pry them out and get them out.
Yeah. And they make wonderful wind chimes.
So not the magnets, but the actual discs.
The platters.
You have a lot of platters on you, huh?
Don't use glass platters for wind chimes. Only use the aluminum ones for wind chimes because the glass ones shatter.
But our laptops and especially our phones, they don't have any discs in them anymore.
Yes. More and more, we're moving towards solid-state devices.
I was going to say, aren't we already past this because we all have Macs and we largely have solid-state drives, so done, right?
Well, the laptop I have originally came with a hard drive, and I replaced it with a solid state.
About precipice. But why is this a software paradigm change? Why do you say it's a precipice? It just means there's not these things that are going to crash, so my data is going to stay.
You go back far enough, and hard drives, or at least that magnetic storage, was literally a million times slower than RAM. And
not literally. That much slower?
Yeah.
Well, the RAM of today or the RAM of yesterday?
No, I mean, just a while back, and especially if you were talking about things like floppies, but many types of storage were so much slower.
Wow.
So like the difference between looking down at the piece of paper that's in front of you and walking 10 miles to the
file cabinet and then searching through to find the item.
And then walking back. Yeah. That's crazy. That's crazy fast.
And the thing is that, yes, hard drives have become faster, much faster. Well, relatively speaking, because when you talk about RAM, let's say we're talking about memory from the late 90s.
Okay.
So SD RAM.
We're talking about the era when the colorful iMac came out.
Just before, yeah.
Okay.
There you have a maximum speed, I think it was something like 800 megs a second of data transfer between the CPU and memory.
Mm-hmm. So that's about as fast as iTalk.
And nowadays you have DDR4. And that is spec'd out to be somewhere in the realm of 20 gigabytes per second.
Approaching Lyle's.
Or 25 gigabytes per second, I'm sorry.
Approaching Lyle's speed of talking.
So that's a big increase during
that
period of time.
30 times.
Yeah, it's big.
It's not a million, but it's
now hard drives. Hard drives back then were in the range of, I think, 25 or 30 megabytes a second transfer rate. And today, your faster ones are going to try to push that envelope to hit 200.
The SSDs or the
hard drives?
No, the hard drives.
The spinning platters.
So the hard drives have also gotten faster. How much faster?
Six times seven.
Six times. They're not going as fast as the rate for RAM.
In the 90s, RAM was a lot faster than hard drives. And both of them got better, but RAM has gotten better faster than hard drives.
Mm-hmm. Hard drives have become the limiting factor.
And in fact, they've kind of always been the limiting factor, right?
They've always been the limiting factor, but it becomes worse and worse. Then comes on the scene solid-state devices. Solid-state devices don't have spinning platters. They don't have to keep those motors around. They don't have to physically move ahead from one end of the platter to the other. They are just strictly electrical devices.
In fact, in a description-wise, they're very similar to RAM.
Yes. Right?
They're addressable memory space.
What kind of speed difference is that?
Well, when they first came out, they were also limited by a bus that was designed for a hard drive.
So the bus is the actual communication mechanism between the processor and the hard drive. Mm-hmm. So that's how the data flows for all the communication.
If you have two people talking to each other, the phone would be the bus.
Right.
You know, and how good the phone line was determined how well you could communicate.
Okay. So the SSDs came out, but the hard drives were kind of defined how much throughput and how much speed you needed. So the SSDs kind of replace the hard drive, and so then they're limited by that bus.
Right. Basically. Well, you had SATA. And
serial attached
SATA,
to it.
Yeah, SATA 2, SATA 3. SATA 1, I believe, was 125 megabytes a second. And that was fine for a hard drive, right? And then you go, well, let's go to SATA 2. That'll go up to 250 megabytes a second.
Double.
And then if you have two hard drives, that would still be able to handle it. But you have a solid-state device come in there, and suddenly they were doing better than the hard drives right out of the box and then hitting that 250 megabyte per second. In fact, if you look at some of the early generation, they have rated speeds of exactly 250 megabytes per second.
Because that's all you could go. Right.
Right.
Wow.
So they went up to SATA 3, and that was 500 megabytes a second.
Double
or
again.
Or terabytes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and you're just noticing all these drives that have that rated speed. That's because the bus can't take it any faster, even if the drive could push it faster.
So they're making the buses twice as fast, and the drives are still faster.
Yes. Which has caused many companies to push that envelope. Apple has done it and many others. It's called the M2 spec within laptops.
This is getting rid of SATA. That's actually a different way of talking to the hard drive.
Okay. You're talking to the main system bus, which is called PCI Express.
Yeah.
Which has a much it's a much larger highway.
And specifically, SATA actually ran on PCI Express. Like, so that's the protocol ran on top of the other protocol, right?
So we're talking about cutting out the middleman here.
Basically,
yeah, that seems
that's exactly
like
what we're talking about doing.
Okay, so when you do that and you get rid of this PCI and you actually get faster drives, this is the precipice you're talking about. At some point, we're going to get to a point where it's so fast that we don't need RAM anymore. I mean, how
Samsung has just demoed a device that fits on a PCI bus, so for a desktop computer that runs at 5 gigabytes per second.
Ten times faster than SATA 3.
Yes, than the maximum theoretical for SATA 3. And if you're looking at PCI Express 4, that is actually subdivided into lanes.
Yep.
If you ever look at some specs for items, you'll see PCI Express X1, mm-hmm. X4, X16.
That's how many lanes the motherboard has.
Right. Right. It's very much like a highway, and how many of the lanes do you get to dedicate to your
and
set of
And it's common for a high-end graphics card to use multiple lanes, for example, because mm-hmm. it needs to have the access to memory and so on.
Yes, okay. And that's why video cards are commonly that X16. This one is not an X16. I believe they're just using four lanes. But at the same time, that's still, for PCI X4, that's still pretty close to saturating that bus.
So the drive is still pushing the limits?
There's still a little bit of headroom, but not that much. Get faster than that, you'll need to start getting into a device that's a by 8 or a by 16.
Okay, so because the SSDs exist now, and we are actually able to store and access data that fast, mm-hmm. Because of that, we're looking at the rest of the chain between the processor and the graphics card to be able to access that data quickly. What do we get when we don't think about that? I guess what you're saying is at some point, the actual storage will be insignificant.
Right. What is the point to all this?
Yeah, well, the bottleneck goes away,
If you are a programmer, the number one thing that you used to do is you avoided network access.
Yeah.
And second after that, you avoided talking to the hard drive. You avoided what's referred to as I.O. Or hard drive. Because of the speed problem. Every time you did it, everything else that you were doing had to grind to a halt. Yeah, it's like you're in a meeting, you're having some conversation, and the person who's taking notes, the secretary, says, "Wait, hold on, let me second. What did you just say? Let me write that down. Don't say anything else until I finish. Okay, now go." That's exactly what's happening in your computer millions of times every second whenever you're talking to
a device. So when that isn't the case, this is the precipice you're talking about, are we getting to the point where the hard drive access is not going to be a limiting factor?
It is still slower, but it's not as slow, which means that it no longer becomes this blanket prohibition. You must never talk to the hard drive unless absolutely necessary. It becomes a much more nuanced conversation. Like, how fast do I need this data to come off? Can the drive do it now? Well, then why even bother? I'll just memory map it.
Let's talk a second about what software looks like when we don't have this limitation, after this precipice, what kind of things we get to do. You're listening to Geek Speak. We'll be right back to talk more about this. You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxel. We're talking with Ben Jaffe and Brian Young. And Miles Elam is talking right now with us about hard drives. So hard drives get faster and faster. SSDs, the connection between the solid-state drive and the processor gets faster and faster and faster and faster. What benefit do we get as users of computers?
Well, better, smarter, faster in general. But
there's a song for that.
Can you give us an example as a software developer that would clarify why this is so great?
If I were using a in-process database, SQLite comes to mind, mm-hmm. Where I'm trying to organize my data and trying to make a query. And at that point, my instinct in the past would have been, I'm going to query the data set that I need ahead of time and put it into RAM, and as much RAM as I had available, I'm going to pull out the exact things that I need at that time and preload it.
So that when I switch between records in my viewing system, it's instantaneous. It's instantaneous because you had a trick, right?
It appears to be instantaneous. Right. Yeah, it's a total smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, you front-loaded all the work.
Right. And web development, we do this all the time, too. We will preload stuff, preload images before we actually plan on displaying them. Otherwise, you end up with those wonderful games where the game seems to start playing, but you're missing some graphics, and then they pop in.
Where's Mario?
Yeah, exactly.
Chop, chop, chop. Oh, there he is.
Well, loading sprites in a video game is a great example of this, right? Normally, one of the things you do when you start it up is everything gets ready. And so that's why applications take a while in the beginning, because everything has to get ready.
That loading bar that says loading, 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 yeah.
That's taking from disk and putting in memory, basically.
Right. Yeah. It means having the devices load that much faster, you really start getting into the realm of, I'm just going to ask for that sprite to come in, because the time it takes for it to display is going to be less than the time it takes for me to do this transition screen from one level to another.
Right. So you're talking about simplicity in software development at some level. Brian, you had an example of people already doing this, or software companies doing this?
Yeah. So I'm an iOS developer, and I try to research my trade and figure out what the latest APIs are. And And there was something that I was excited to hear about in built into the operating system, built into the libraries for iOS, is that when you're using a certain kind of way to show an image on the screen, they're doing all this in the background. They're doing what they call memory mapping, which is basically they're just pretending like this is in RAM, and for the programmer, they don't have to think about it. To them, it appears like it's in RAM, but the system behind the scenes is just going and grabbing that right off the SSD really, really fast, where you wouldn't even know the difference.
Okay, and that's interesting because when we're talking about like a graphic situation like that, where you need to show an image in a graphics card, there's actually two things that needs access to it, right? There's the disk needs to get, the processor needs it potentially, and also the graphics card might need it. And so where it goes sometimes is just shuffling bits around. But if you tell the graphics card, just get it from the disk, it could potentially be faster.
Yeah. The whole history of programming in computers has been this history of reducing the complexity for the programmer. And this is just one more layer that a programmer may not have to think about.
Point of order. Reducing complexity for the programmer. I don't know if the hardware is doing that. The hardware is constantly getting more complex. Some of the tools are improving that. But,
well, it's a battle.
And I don't want to say that things are becoming simpler for developers. I actually don't believe that.
No. But there is a general thrust of hiding that complexity under more and more layers of API.
But you're adding complexity on top for all those things that would have been untenable before.
I don't know. I think that software development's gotten easier over the years. I've just gotten more experience.
But what we can do with it is so much more than we could 20 years ago or so on.
So this software, this SSD that you're talking about, Miles, is it coming into production soon? Are we going to start seeing this stuff happen?
Actually, the one for laptops, when we were talking the M.2 spec,
yeah,
which is the type that you would find if you looked inside of a MacBook or a Sony laptop. A few others are starting to come around to getting them as well because they're smaller than a typical laptop drive chassis. Another advantage to SSDs is that you can make them smaller than that form factor that fits a spinning platter. That's 2.5 gigabytes a second.
That's pretty fast.
And just in case someone was confused about that, not gigabits per second, gigabytes per second.
Okay, it's fast.
So
so we're seeing a precipice. Software is going to change because of this, and very awesome. Thank you, Miles.
Yeah, really to the point where like spinning platters are going to be relegated to that same thing we had before for like tapes. Like, you just want mass storage.
I had a conversation with my wife recently, and she said, wait, people still use tape for backup? I'm like, yeah, tape backup's very common still. And she was amazed by that, of course, because you don't see it in everyday life. Right. But for business, it still makes
sense. Actually, one last little bit, which is the largest hard drives, single hard drives, not like arrays of hard drives, but a single hard drive that I've seen have been 6 terabytes. I don't know if any of you have seen any larger than that, but I've seen six. SSDs are now at 2.
Right, already.
2 terabytes.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
So they are gaining traction very
quickly.
It was
for a while that SSDs were smaller.
Yeah, like they used to be 128 gigabytes versus, say, a 2 terabyte hard drive.
Yeah, but there's still the price difference. It's
yes,
coming down.
But that price difference is I mean, that's really where it comes down to hard drives becoming like tape. They're cheaper on that mass storage line, but nowadays a lot of people don't get tapes because hard drives are
cheap
become
enough.
So cheap.
Yeah.
What happens when SSDs hit that point? And they're purely electrical. You don't have a mechanism in there. There's a lot of
reliability.
That's going to move faster toward that cheap side than the hard drives are going to be able to match.
All right, we've talked about space. We've talked about sci-fi with space. We talked about hard drives and computers. The other thing we talk a lot about is social networks. Let's skip social networks today, okay? Let's just not even
mention
it at all. Yeah, it'd be fun. We actually had a correction in the beginning about Facebook. So, okay, darn, we didn't do it this time. But let's go ahead and talk about communications. Phones, maybe?
Well, this is kind of a really, really old social network. So
that's true. The original social network.
Yeah, going back to party lines. So, yeah, so we've had this technology, the simple telephone, for 100 years. Maybe more?
Longer, sure.
Well, that's going back to the telegraph. So about 12 years ago, I moved up to the mountains where we had previously been settling our life completely around cell phones. And that was a nice, simple, easy way to communicate. My wife had a number. I had a number. People could call us. You know the story. But we moved up to the mountains and we had really bad signal. In fact, at first, we couldn't use our cell phones at all inside the house. And this started a long road for me to try to figure out a way to simplify having a house number and a cell number for each of us and being able to know where our messages are being left. And at the same time, reducing our bill each month. Because back then, a long-distance deal was like $50 a month.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So,
did you install a landline in your house?
Yeah, we had two landlines actually, because we had to have one for the modem because we didn't have cable yet.
Plus, also, there's the issue of someone calling you, getting your answering machine, which says, hey, you can reach me at this number. Oh, I got to remember 10 numbers in my head for a second so I can call them on this other number.
So as a geek, I wanted to simplify this. I didn't want to have to think where my messages were left. I hated that feeling that somebody might have left a message on my home answering machine 6 hours ago, and I didn't know where that was there. So I started this long search. First, I started off with cell tower repeaters. These were radio devices that literally repeated the signal from the cell tower, strengthened it, and broadcast it into the house so we could use our cell phones.
And these are normally provided by the cell phone carrier themselves, but you pay for it.
Well, do they do that nowadays? This was actually a complete radio device.
Oh, okay.
I think what you're thinking about is the femto cells.
Yeah, sure.
Those work off the internet that we'll get to in a bit. I didn't actually use one of those. But this whole repeating the cell phone signal is limited to a single a cell carrier. You can't just switch between Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile. So then I moved up to something called Google Voice that was coming out then. It was actually at that time called Grand Central.
Yes.
Because this had the promise that this was going to make things less expensive and a lot more unified, simplified in my life.
Ben,
do you know
about Brian, I was there right with you. Yeah, I remember when they changed the name from Grand Central to Google Voice, and I'm like, oh my God,
Service by Google, which is still available, called Google Voice, gives you a real phone number. People can call it, and that real phone number the things, right?
It's funny you call it a real phone number, because I call it a virtual phone number, because it's not connected to a phone.
It's kind of a fake phone number.
In most cases,
I mean a real phone number, because when you give it to somebody, it's a phone number. They can call it.
It's not like,
oh yeah, I see.
Like Skype. Although Skype can have a phone number. It's not like Skype where it's just some internet name. Yes, it's a real phone number that somebody can call. In fact, somebody can text it as well. So
And that voice, if you don't do anything else, the voice message that's left on it or the text that's left on it gets sent to your email. And you can access it through a website and get it through email.
Yes. At first, it was email we were getting it by. But then when the smartphones came out and there was apps on the phone, that was the first app I went looking for. And pretty quickly, a developer made it. And so it was like getting text messages on my phone, only I wasn't using the text service.
Yeah, you were using Wi-Fi.
Right.
From your home. Or wherever you were.
Let me back up. So
sure.
With Google Voice, you can tell it to send it to send the phone call to any phone and send the text message to another phone or to your email or to an app. And so what I was trying to do is make this really simple for me and my wife. And we'd have an app on our phone. And when somebody called us, our phone would ring through this app instead of through the regular dialer.
And that would work at your house even though you didn't have cell coverage because you did have Wi-Fi coverage.
And that was the key. That was the key. If I didn't have cell coverage, it would still work. That promise never came true.
Why not?
Because the apps were never given enough power to hook into the operating system to make it seamless. There was always problems.
Always
I could
problems.
Never rely on the app.
But you're an Apple person. How about on Android?
I didn't have an Android phone, I think, when I started this. But the idea was that this one phone number was almost like everything passed through this phone number, and then it could distribute it to a Skype number on your computer or some other kind of VoIP SIP number or your cell phone or your home phone number. Or it could ring all of them. And the first one that you answer, it would route it through there.
One of the things I first did when I got a Google Voice is I visited my mother and she had a landline and I had no internet there and my cell phone didn't work there. So I had my phone ring her phone. Mm-hmm. And of course, when it rang, we wouldn't know who it was. We'd pick it up and it wasn't for my mom or for me. We wouldn't necessarily know.
The problem that I encountered, I'm sure you probably encountered this too, is that because it was proxying through this machine, this other machine, which was handling my Google Voice number, you would say, hey, Ben, and it would take a second. And then I'd say, hey, Lyle, and you would already started talking. It was kind of like being on a bad, VoIP line or something.
So Google Voice didn't work for you because of the complexity of receiving the call. It wouldn't actually ring necessarily until you had the app installed.
It got better over time.
I couldn't make it simple enough to just give it to my wife and say, okay, this is our number. I just couldn't trust that. But what Ben was saying, that latency, that delay, that was also terrible in the beginning. It got a little better, but the call quality was always less.
Yeah.
It was either a delay or it was just fuzzier. I couldn't hear it well. So the reason why I'm talking about this today is because I got really excited, and we've talked about it briefly on the show a couple times, about Wi-Fi calling. And I had the hope that maybe this is going to be finally the one thing that's going to simplify my life, that no matter where I am, as long as there's Wi-Fi, maybe it'll work seamless. And
And specifically, this is AT&T, or like a main carrier, providing this as part of their service. T-Mobile's done this for a long time. If you have a T-Mobile phone number and you have Wi-Fi, but you don't have cell coverage, it'll still work. Is that kind of what it is?
So I want to back up and explain a couple technologies real quick. So everybody knows what a landline phone is. Mm-hmm. Sound goes over copper wire and gets turned into a sound on the other end. I should say electrical pulses.
Also known as POTS.
Yes.
Plain old telephone service.
And everybody has some idea of what a cell system is. It's based on radio waves, and your handset sends the radio wave up to a tower, gets turned into maybe one of those POTS lines, or sent over the internet, which is the way most of this traffic goes now. Then there's VoIP, and we've talked about VoIP before. This is voice over IP. This is turning it... digitizing the sound, sending it as packets over the internet.
And IP stands for Internet Protocol.
Right. Mm-hmm. So those are the basic underlying technologies. Google Voice uses a combination of VoIP and sends it over to plain telephone lines or over the cell network. It's routing all this through these different technologies. Now, what Wi-Fi calling is a way of grafting VoIP onto your phone to send your phone conversation over the internet. The internet going through your phone or going through your home Wi-Fi. And the important part here is it's doing it seamlessly so that somebody can call me at my number. And if my phone doesn't have cell service and it does have Wi-Fi service, my phone will ring and I'll be able to talk just as if it's a regular cell phone call. And that's the simplicity I've been looking for ages.
And the thing that's frustrating as developers, we've known the entire time the cell phone companies could do it because we knew that at the other side of that cell tower, that antenna, they were connected to the internet. And right there means that they could have done that right to our phone.
Right.
And that's been so frustrating that they haven't done it. Now, T-Mobile has done it, for a long time. Recently, your carrier. What's your carrier?
So my carrier is AT&T. Uh-huh. And let's back up. And Sprint has also had it. Yep. In fact, Sprint had some excellent integration with Google Voice so that it was seamless
that.
In that way. And did that work out well for you?
It worked out all right. And then I switched to Ting, which is a Sprint reseller. And of course, everything's awkward again. But I love Ting and their customer service, so I'm sticking with them.
So a quick question. Does this cost any more, having the Wi-Fi?
Okay, so this gets a little confusing. There's different kinds of costs. There's cost for the service, and then there's cost for talking on the phone. And it's different with every carrier. But most of them, as far as I can tell, do not charge to turn this service on if they offer it. But some of the carriers will charge you a per minute charge for talking on it, and some will not.
Why would they do that?
Well, why did they charge for text messages back in the day?
So wrong.
Here's the thing, just to make this clear, my take on it anyway, is that some of these carriers may want to have you pay to improve the coverage to their network, effectively.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you are taking load.
Cheaper for them as well.
You're taking load off of their network in order to do this.
And you pay for it. Well, wait, you're using AT&T.
I'm using AT&T.
Does it charge you per minute to use Wi-Fi calling?
Well, I've switched over to a plan that doesn't have per minute charges for talking on the phone anymore. So I don't know for sure, but I believe if you had a pay per minute plan, they would be charging you.
If that's not the case, you have to tell us next week. When you finally get your bill and it's all nasty, you have to tell us.
Sometime soon, I'm actually switching to Google Fi, which is Google's entry into the space. They've basically set it up where they can use Wi-Fi calling, VoIP kind of a thing, and Sprint and T-Mobile's network. So for their particular Nexus line of devices, which their at least externally stated goal is not to compete in the cell phone network, but to kind of push innovation forward, those cell phones, particularly the 6, whatever it is, 6P, 6 something, and
Nexus.
The 5 something, the new Nexuses have chips in them that both support Sprint and T-Mobile and can also switch between those networks for phone calls.
Mm-hmm. So I want to let you know two things real quick. Verizon has applied for a permit to be able to do the same thing. So they're on the road. So all the 4 major carriers plus many of the smaller ones are definitely going to be offering this. The other thing to know is that when you use a service like this, it's like VoIP. There are issues with the 911 service.
Mm-hmm.
When it goes over the Wi-Fi, it can't know where you're located. Well, it can, but it doesn't know where you're located. So you have to put an address in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I'm over at Lyle's house and I use 911 on my phone and it's over the Wi-Fi service, there's a potential there for 911 not knowing where I was.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Now, really quick personal question. Should I stop using your Google Voice number?
No. I ported it over.
Okay,
I paid the $3 to Google so they would let me port it over to my phone number. So
now that's your only phone number?
That's my only phone number. The other one won't work. Although I have to check to see whether Apple's hijacking my iMessages.
We'll have one more geek story in just a second. I think Ben had something to see online. But I want to let you know that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use our stuff any way you'd like it, as long as you give us credit. This is Public Radio for Central Coast 889 KOSP Santa Cruz, live online at kosp.org. To find out more about this or anything about GeekSpeak, any episode of GeekSpeak, you can go online and visit us at geekspeak.org, and we're on social networks at KOSP Geeks is our kind of handle. And of course, you can email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell with Brian Young, Miles Elam, and also Ben Jaffe. Ben, you got one more story?
I do. Kip Teague of the Project Apollo Archive uploaded 8,400 high-resolution photos of NASA's lunar missions.
Oh, nice.
All 11 of them, basically a stream of consciousness. Not just the good ones, all of them.
That's fantastic. So a whole bunch of images from Apollo mission you can get to from geekspeak.org. For GeekSpeak's October 31st episode, this is Lyle Troxell, and thank you Brian, Miles, and Ben, and also to Greg and Chandler for supporting us via the internets. Thank you all, and see you next week.